Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. We start this week with a look at survivors of crime, people and families who've been victimized, the kinds of services and assistance they need, and how sometimes in politics they get used. Lenora Anderson is the co-founder and president of the Alliance for Safety and Justice.
So in the 1970s, that's the time period where many people, identify the origin of the victims' rights movement in the United States. The victims' rights movement in the United States emerged from sort of a divergent set of precursors. Feminist movement concerns lifted up about victims of sexual assault and victims of domestic violence being ignored. Many people who had experienced repeated crime lifting up the failure of local law enforcement and criminal justice system to adequately address repeat cycles of violence. There were concerns that are legitimate. We have not ever had a criminal justice system that was designed at its foundation to really meet the needs of most victims of crime. In the legal sense, right? We have an adversarial criminal justice system where it's essentially the state versus the person being accused of a crime. And in that contest between the state and the representatives of the defendant, victims are legally witnesses at best. And that's essentially all. So victim disregard and even re-traumatization through that process is something that had been going on for a long time. So those legitimate concerns were lifted up in the 70s and the 80s. But what happened in response was the challenge. The response to the concern of victim disregard by the criminal justice system was to beef up the criminal justice system. There was a sort of a usurping of that message of forgotten victims, and politicians of all stripes, didn't matter political persuasion, politicians started sort of stepping over each other to appear tougher and tougher on crime for the purposes of supporting those forgotten victims. There were a couple of things that emerged from that. We saw victims' rights amendments passed across the country. These are typically constitutional amendments that give victims rights to speak in criminal court, rights to access things like restitution, compensation. That's what happened on paper in terms of the literal shift in legal rights that victims have. But at the same time, politically, those calls were combined with a call for fewer opportunities for release for people who were incarcerated, fewer what was referred to as amenities for people in prison, where we're actually going to toughen that prison environment. And longer and longer sentences, sort of the ratcheting up of the mandatory enhancements of all stripes. Well, those increases in power led to a shift in money and political influence for a whole bunch of criminal justice bureaucracies. But giving those very bureaucracies who have never really been very good at meeting victims' needs more power and really miss the mark in terms of the actual real world impact on victims. And I'll just summarize a couple of the real world impacts. One is that at the foundational level in American criminal justice, there is a hierarchy of harm. There is a hierarchy of whose pain has mattered, whose victimization has really mattered to the criminal justice system and whose has not. This has been expressed along race and socioeconomic lines. This shows up in terms of which cases make the nightly news, to which prosecutions or investigations are taken most seriously, all the way over to which victims are trusted on the witness stand or given access to compensation. So there's this discrimination that is happening across the spectrum in terms of victims. The empowerment of the criminal justice system never addressed that. That hierarchy of harm, in fact, became more extreme as we built up the power of the criminal justice system. The second thing is that is really important to understand is because that justice system growth essentially meant mass incarceration and mass surveillance, primarily in communities of color, you actually lessened the trust of everyday folks with the justice system, which has the impact of reducing the likelihood that people will report crime, reducing the likelihood that people support what the criminal justice system's gonna do in response. So you've got expanded discrimination, you've got less trust, and finally, Doug, a ton of money going to a system that means we're not actually investing in capacitating communities for prevention. It's really critical for people who may not be as familiar with how our justice system works to understand just how much it is a part of the cycle of trauma. At this point, experts, people who've been working on violence prevention and community safety understand quite a bit about the causes of the cycle of crime and violence. You know, we have a saying, those of us who've worked in criminal justice and public safety, we say, hurt people, right? And what that means is we well know that if we don't provide people with basic access to crisis assistance and safety, and when people get hurt, don't help them recover, that is going to be a contributor to a cycle of harm. And that hurt people bears out when you look at the statistics. You know, when you look at who's going into our criminal justice system, 90% of the people who enter our prisons and jails have histories of trauma, histories of victimization. And one of the questions, you know, that we ask is, long before anyone committed a crime, what was done in response to their experiences of victimization? If nothing was done, we have to understand that we're kind of contributing to that cycle. Well, there's another saying, and that other saying that we have is healed people healed people. So at the same time that we know that hurt people, we can interrupt the cycle of trauma and do something different. It's just not what our criminal justice system is very good at doing. Look just specifically at the conditions inside prisons and jails. These are toxic conditions. These are conditions literally designed from the ground up to cause trauma, right? To cause hyper stress, to cause a re-triggering of PTSD, sleeplessness, depression, isolation. These are facilities that are designed to essentially cut people off from humanity. That is how we have, as you know, sort of as a society, responded to the cycle of trauma, is to place people in facilities and in conditions that are traumatizing in themselves. So you can see how that just continues to contribute. Many people have eloquently described the struggles of trying to recover from the experience of incarceration. They're very similar to the struggles of trying to recover from any number of things that can cause severe trauma. We can interrupt it. Trauma recovery centers, rehabilitation, cognitive behavioral therapy. There are so many opportunities to do something different, to put people on a path to behavior change. But it's going to have to start with empathy and not toxic incarceration. Yeah, there's this, you know, we talk about the myths in the criminal justice system. And one of the myths that's really, pervasive is this myth that, you have, you know, people who commit crime and people who are victims, and never the twain shall meet. They, you know, there's no overlap between these two sort of permanent populations. And then the job of the justice system then is very simple, which is to find the people who commit crimes and, you know, incapacitate them for as long as possible. That is, you know, that oversimplification might make for good sound bites, but it is actually very harmful from a public safety policy perspective. You know, the reality is we're actually talking about concentric or, you know, overlapping circles, the Venn diagram, right? We're talking about, you know, the life circumstances facing people who are hurt by crime and violence, especially people who are repeatedly hurt by crime and violence. The life circumstances that they often face are markedly similar to the life circumstances of people who end up perpetrating a crime. And understanding that we're actually talking about a Venn diagram where many people who are in the center of that have at one point been a victim of crime and at the next point may have perpetrated a crime. That complexity, if we could have a justice system that was better at understanding that complexity, it would be better at stopping that cycle. Right. Again, you know, when we're talking about a cycle of trauma, if we're empowering a justice system that is not very good at distinguishing between vulnerability and dangerousness, if we have a justice system that really can't make that distinction very effectively, then we're contributing to that cycle of trauma instead of interrupting it. So it's really important to understand these overlapping life circumstances. And it makes a big difference in terms of how you seek to resolve the issues. One of the things that we talk a lot about at our organization is the need to just engage with victims of crime about policy and about solutions. You talked about the fact that there's this very low trust, that the justice system has, especially in communities that are sort of overrun by mass surveillance and mass incarceration. And part of that low trust is whatever's going to happen isn't going to resolve the underlying issue. So engaging with victims, whether that's through victimization surveys or through community asset mapping or through just direct dialogue with groups of victims, you can come up with new solutions to that cycle emerge. Just one example, we did a focus group with survivors of domestic violence in rural Illinois. And across the board, what the survivors of domestic violence worried about was if they were to report, the justice system would only arrest and the person would only get worse, and then the person would then be released. And so what they wanted was help for that person, help to change behavior, violence, prevention, toxic behaviors need to be addressed and transformed. And that's what that group of survivors wanted to see, was what does real rehabilitation look like? Yes, I need this person away from me, but how are you going to change behavior? What the justice system is currently doing is not that. There's a wide range of solutions here, whether it's restorative justice, whether it's mental health treatment, substance use disorder treatment, trauma recovery. These are the kinds of things that engaging with survivors will result in becoming more and more popular as the solutions.
That was Lenora Anderson, co-founder and president of the Alliance for Safety and Justice, speaking at an event recently hosted by the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center at The Ohio State University entitled In Their Names, The Untold Story of Victims' Rights, Mass Incarceration, and the Future of Public Safety. We'll have more in a moment. I'm Doug McVeigh. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. Now, here's Shakira Diaz, Chief of Federal Advocacy at the Alliance for Safety and Justice.
So this hierarchy of harm is really about attributing value, not just to individuals, but to entire communities, right? And determining whether or not those people are deserving of any support. In many ways, you know, Aswad and I grew up very similarly. My first friend was shot and killed when my first exposure to gun violence was when a friend of mine was shot and killed when I was 14 years old. I have lost over 40 friends and loved ones to gun violence. But my personal experience in terms of interacting with the justice system started out at a particular moment in my life. I was the victim of stalking for a 5-year period. It started the junior year after the summer after my junior year. And it was a very long period of time. My senior year in college, I went out with a friend of mine who put something in a drink of mine and sexually assaulted me. I never reported that sexual assault because of how the system was interacting with me as somebody who was actively being stalked, even though I knew who assaulted me, sexually assaulted me. So we fast forward to me being somebody who was a former educator professionally. I graduated from college, become an educator, leave that field because I wanted to get a better understanding of policies that were impacting the lives of my students. I was fortunate enough to work at my old high school and just saw these insurmountable barriers and saw how the school that I graduated from had changed dramatically. I'd seen, you know, metal detectors erected, soap in the bathroom removed, and my students having my French book that was 30 years old when I had it. So I wanted to understand where are the resources going? Why is it so hard for my students and their families to like get ahead despite the fact that they're so committed? And my very first campaign in this space was centered around this problem that was persistent in Cleveland that everyone knew about and just accepted. It was just common thing. This is how it goes down. And the issue was that people within the city limits, within the city of Cleveland, who were arrested with no drugs, but a crack pipe, which is technically a misdemeanor, paraphernalia possession, were going to prison with a felony conviction. And only people from Cleveland who were primarily African-American were going to prison in Ohio's prisons for this particular offense. Well, why is that? The reason was that the city of Cleveland was choosing to test crack pipes, the paraphernalia, for cocaine residue, and then charge folks under the state code, the Ohio Revised Code, for cocaine possession, which is a felony. So they were superseding, right? Just really ramping up the one felony convictions and who was going to prison. After a couple of years, we were able to work on the issue. Cleveland decided to change their policy. During that time, it's uncovered that there was, unfortunately and tragically, a man who was eventually arrested and sentenced to prison for kidnapping and killing 11 African-American women. And one of those women who became a leader within our network was instrumental in changing policies in the state of Ohio. But it's important to name her story. She was able to get away. She escaped. She called the police and shared what she had seen in this home. And she was told that they couldn't come to her, that she needed to come to the police station. Several women were killed after that. This woman, who's seen some of the most horrific things that no one should see, is later arrested on a probation violation for drug possession. And while she's in jail, the man who kidnapped her, who had killed all these women, was also in jail. And she told the judge and anyone who would listen, "I've been in that house. I know what that man did," which led to further investigation and uncovering that the city of Cleveland had not been testing rape kits for decades. And for me, that was such a profound moment. Because I know that the city of Cleveland was investing a lot of time and a lot of resources in testing crack pipes for the specific purpose of overcharging and sending people to prison. The majority of our public safety resources, or a significant number of our public safety resources, are going to minor drug possession enforcement. Meanwhile, you have a situation where people who are being harmed are being ignored. The family members of these women attempted to report that their family members were missing, and they were completely ignored. They, in many cases, their reports weren't even taken. These families had to create their own flyers. So it's terribly heartbreaking to know where our public dollars are going and to know who's being ignored. So this woman who could not get any help as a crime victim, who is relying, who's left on her own, like many crime victims, to figure out and numb themselves through this trauma, comes in contact with the justice system, not because they're trying to help her, but they're criminalizing her because of how she's dealing with the disregard and the survivor's guilt that she has, which she carried heavily. Back in this time period, the city of Cleveland said, okay, we're going to start testing rape kits. Eventually, so what ends up happening is, like, after uncovering all these untested rape kits, AG DeWine, who is now Governor DeWine, launches this initiative to support the testing of rape kits across the state of Ohio. And, you know, a few years ago, while I was working at ASJ, maybe about 2 years by then, I'm home with my daughter, she's sick, and someone comes to my door pounding and kicking at my door. I didn't open the door. The person put a subpoena into my Mayo shoot. I read it, and I was being asked to testify or appear in court for the man who had been stalking me several years prior. So I called the prosecutor's office and I said, you know, I know that your office is going to be reaching out to hundreds of sexual assault victims whose rape kit you had not tested. They were trying to re-engage folks, right? And I said, maybe you shouldn't send people to our homes who are going to pound and kick at our doors as if we are criminals. And the response that I got from the prosecutor's office was, well, we'll try to talk to them, but the people who are doing this are also serving warrants. So this is how they engage. Our membership in the Alliance for Safety and Justice is Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice, Underserved Victims of Crime, and Time Done, which is our constituency of people with past convictions. The reason that we do the work the way that we do it is because our folks, our membership, which the majority of our staff identifies as one or the other, understands that unaddressed trauma will lead you to the justice system. It is the only way that systemically we are seen, because when we need support, we are completely ignored and disregarded. And however we try to cope with, deal with, heal, is criminalized. So it creates this dichotomy where often when we're talking to policymakers initially, because we've been conditioned to believe that crime victims are this group and folks who are in contact with the justice system are in this group, our folks understand that there's a bridge there, that there's an overlap there, because we have experienced that disregard. We know where the investments are going. We know that we are being targeted for arrest for the most minor things and completely disregarded systemically, whether it's through legislation, policy, investments, when we are victims of crime or when we need support the most. When we started working, Oswald and I started working in 2016 to kind of build up like that membership base of chapters of folks who had been impacted by the justice system, right? The folks that are typically ignored. And we were able to elevate, like, where are the gaps? What are the things that folks want to change? What are the policies that we want to elevate? And this is the way that we do it. And we call it trauma-informed organizing. Because first and foremost, it's valuing that individual and their healing journey. And then assessing, okay, well, what could make things different? You know, in Ohio, we've been able to work very effectively. We were involved in the passage of SB 66, which elevated and prioritized rehabilitation within our prison systems. TCAP expansion under House Bill 49 a few years back, which was a state budget. We worked in partnership with the state attorney general's office under Governor DeWine and now under AG Yost to become the state with the second highest number of trauma recovery centers in the country. We recently passed Senate Bill 36, which removed barriers to victims' compensation for people with past convictions. Where we saw that challenge particularly were like parents with past convictions who lost their children to homicide, who were unable to get the resources to bury their children. That's no longer an issue because we work with our membership and with electeds to change that, as well as making sure that victims of sexual assault who had drugs in their system at the time of victimization are now able to access resources. And most recently, Senate Bill 288. You know, we worked on specifically on elevating the expansion of transitional control, judicial control, and earned credit. We understand that it's important for us to work on both ends of the spectrum. So that's part of what we've done in Ohio. Aswa can speak more about what we've done across the country. But these voices are important. And I'll say that we've been able to work very successfully with folks on both sides of the aisle because what we're lifting up is safety. That's not controversial. What we're lifting up is healing and support for communities. So we've been able to do that very effectively.
That was Shakira Diaz, Chief of Federal Advocacy Alliance for Safety and Justice, speaking at an event recently hosted by the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center at The Ohio State University entitled In Their Names, The Untold Story of Victims' Rights, Mass Incarceration, and the Future of Public Safety. I'm Doug McVeigh. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. From Victims to Decrim, Julian Jackson is Director of Movement Building at the Partnership for Safety and Justice.
So Oregon voters may remember that we passed Measure 110 in November 2020, which made Oregon the first state in the country to decriminalize drug use and substance use disorder. We have 50 years of evidence that the war on drugs is a colossal failure. It did little, if anything, to help people. And in fact, under this approach, Oregon was second in the nation in drug use and addiction and last in the nation in access to drug treatment. So we worked to pass Measure 110, which decriminalized drug possession and at the same time committed to invested hundreds of millions of dollars into community programs that support people who have experienced addiction. So Measure 110 is working both to shrink our system and to invest in our communities. As a result of Measure 110, more than 60,000 Oregonians have received services, and that number is growing. The measure keeps our state's commitment to people and their families and communities to increase the availability of free local services for people struggling with substance abuse. Measure 110 funded programs that are now standing up in every single county. People who are on waiting lists are now getting services. Outreach workers are out on the streets. Beds are opening up.
That was Julian Jackson, Director of Movement Building at the Partnership for Safety and Justice. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Justice shows intentions.